You're listening to the Pentaract Poetry Podcast, hosted by Anthony Etherin.
Welcome to episode 24 of the Pentaract Podcast. Joining us this time are Kate Siklosi, Gregory Betts, and Nasser Hussein, who are here to discuss the past, present, and future of experimental poetry in Canada. We began by asking them to introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Kate. I am a poet and a wayward scholar who has defenestrated from the ivory tower somewhat. I got a leg in still because I still teach, but in my day job, I work to reduce barriers for folks to access employment, and I hold businesses accountable to that, which I take a lot of pleasure in. And yeah, I'm a primarily visual poet, although I dabble with words on occasion. And just super happy to be here and talking with all my friends here.
And a publisher.
And a publisher. Oh yeah, that thing. Yes, also publisher, small press publisher, Gap Riot, and yeah, just like super into small press publishing, as you all know. And really excited to continue the Small Press Map project this year with the Toronto International Festival of Authors. So we're actually just about finalizing the submission form to get more people added, and it's going to be really interactive and fun. So yeah, lots of small press stuff happening.
And Gregory. Short introduction, please.
I am Gregory Betts. I'm here in St. Catharines, Ontario, and I'm a writer, and I'm a professor, and I've been doing this for a little while, feeling the years today. But I published my first poem back in the year 2000. And it was published by Derek Beaulieu. It was an anagrammatic mistranslation of B.P. Nicol. And since then, it's been sort of a steady, constant process. It's been a lifestyle in a lot of ways. What's amazing is to see something like the project that you guys were just talking about, the Judith Project. It feels like there's been this eruption of experimental, avant-garde, visual, concrete poetry. Just all of a sudden, it's a nexus point moment where suddenly there's a huge hunger for this kind of work, and it's really remarkable to see. The stuff of the shadows and the margins is now claiming its own center. It's wonderful. I do visual poetry. I do constraint-based poetry. Most of my work is stolen or plagiarized. That's been a recurring motif. I like to work with other people's words as a foundation. And I try to basically, I guess, I think I come up with different ways in order to engage with other people's writings and respond and think through them. And that's been a recurring motif in all of my work. And I've published with Pentaract Press in the past too. So thrilled about all that. Thrilled to be here and in this gathering.
Thank you. And Nasser.
Hi everyone. I'm Nasser. Nasser Hussein. I work in Leeds at the university, at Leeds Beckett University. Yeah, I'm a writer, and in spite of everything, I keep coming back to constraint-based stuff and VisPo. Although, and maybe this will come up later, I'm starting to try and figure ways out of these modes as well. I may have questions perhaps for all of us here as practitioners in these kinds of very niche ways of writing. And yeah, I'm really just looking forward to a fun conversation with you guys tonight. I haven't seen many of you in a very long time. So yeah, just happy to be here.
There's a lot to talk about, isn't there, with why we do it.
Yeah.
And I think we can get onto that. I mean, this is our main focus today. We'll be talking about Canadian poetry, but we can touch upon a lot of things. This was kind of inspired by something that came up, Nasser, when you and I recorded our podcast about a year ago, I think.
Gosh, yeah, about that time.
Because we talked about the differences between British poetry and Canadian poetry, in particular how Canadians seem to embrace the experimental and the visual perhaps more than the British do. Or when the British do it, we're seen as sort of quirky outsiders, whereas certain Canadian poets are able to be considered mainstream figures, like B.P. Nicol, who's already been mentioned in this podcast several times.
Well, I think you have to blame Derek Bowley for that mostly, right?
For B.P. Nicol?
Well, for creating Vispo as a kind of mainstream thing. I mean, he, Greg, you mentioned him, you know, as sort of perhaps even launching your poetic career in a way, right? I'm sure he'd love to think that was the case, but.
I know, I often tribute him with that. I acknowledge that. He makes me buy him drinks. I happily pay for them, no problem.
And there's, you know, I think that's what better marketing arm for Canadian experimentalism than having someone like Derek.
But there's also a weird thing too, where like the legacy of the boomers and that whole 60s explosion, they're really, you know, there's a moment of cementing legacies that's at work here. And there's also a mining of that glut of writing and information that came pouring out of that moment. I mean, we had this, Kate, you might remember this, the Four Horsemen Project. Was that about 5 years ago, 6 years ago? It was a musical dance version of B.P. Nicol's poetry that was put on by a main theater company doing like a full musical on B.P. Nicol. Mm-hmm. And I went to that with Paul Dutton, and he's just sitting there looking beside me with a big grin on his face saying, this isn't what we intended. but there is a moment where all of a sudden you can do stuff like that. There's a dance company in Toronto at Harbourfront that did a version of Christian Books' Eunoia. And hundreds of people show up every night to see it. And what a strange experience that is. I took my mom to that one, and she said, this is not my usual theater, but it was but it was fun, right? And the fun and the energy of it came through. Maybe some of the radical politics beneath it didn't come through, but some of the energy and sort of the raw innovation comes through.
Were the books available? Was it kind of tied in, like so that people might be able to access some of those politics via the text? Or
That's interesting. At Christians, it certainly was.
Okay.
But for the Volcano Project, Four Horsemen,
it's hard. Yeah, there's not many texts to begin with, I suppose. Like,
yes, yeah, the scores. And I don't think there's any Four Horsemen titles in print right now.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Mm. Yeah, like the Prosta too. Like all the ones. They were such ephemeral publications to begin with, and there's a project for somebody in a reprint edition, right?
I'm making a note right now, right?
Just so people know, if one of you, I'll let you decide who wants to do it, could talk about the Four Horsemen and what that project was.
I can do a quick little sketch because I'm sort of the resident historian with these kind of things. I'm less active in the present than I am in the past. the Four Horsemen were a sound poetry collective that emerged in the 60s and 70s, led and coordinated by B.P. Nicol. One of the things that was striking about their performance and their mode was that they were really invested in the voice and the raw organic voice. So they didn't use any technology, they didn't use instruments, and they didn't actually record. And so there's very few actual professional recordings of them. There are a couple. Ron Mann used one of his in his Comic Book Confidential series. And there are some recordings out there. They were all connected with the Therafields psychoanalytic community in Toronto, which used scream therapy as part of their methodology for analysis and cure. And there was a curative element to this scream. And so when you listen to them, you can think about them not just as, you know, making funny noises, which they did, but also as trying to think about new ways for the human body to realign itself inside, you know, late capitalism, Vietnam War, nonsense, empires, and colonialism. So they were an activist space. They didn't last too long. I should know exactly the year that they ended, but it was mid-70s. Might have made it to 80.
Yeah, I think it was early 80s,
I should know that. I don't offhand. But they were a foursome who were deeply influential on sound poetry in Canada and helped to coordinate the Sound Poetry Festival, which came to Toronto and was, you know, sort of a hub for that activity. And just a remarkable group and as soon as it ended, they all kind of scattered off in different directions. And I think it tested their patience for each other, but they were extremely productive and powerful. I mean, if you think about the kind of work they were doing, it's the kind of stuff that brings out so much emotion and intensity that I can understand why you'd, after finishing something like that, you'd need a space to navigate the implications of what you've just done. Anyways, they traveled the world and performed all over, and now there's musicals about their accomplishments.
Yeah, and it's hard to talk about sound poetry really without referencing the Four Horsemen. And I think that's a lot of maybe, I guess we are touching the wellspring in a lot of ways with B.P. Nichol, Steve McCaffrey, Paul Raphael Barreto, do I have that right?
Paul Dutton, Steve Raphael,
and BP. Maybe it'd be fun to sketch out a kind of lineage, because I always jump from BP Nichol to Darren Wishler Henry. Like, if I'm trying to think about where I come from, you know, in or some kind of lineage inside of Canadian experimentalism.
In their book, Sound Poetry, a Catalog, they put the start at a French-Canadian artist named Claude Gauvreau, who was part of the Automatisse movement. Right. And he was doing collage words, like neologisms, but that pulling into pure sound. And in fact, he has some just exquisite sound poetry in these made-up words. And he was sort of the first when he started in the 40s, and then Bissett in the early 60s, and then BP learned from Bissett and brought that scene to Toronto. And then McCaffrey came to Canada in 68 from Manchester?
Yorkshire area, Yorkshire. Yeah.
Kate and I had an event way back many years ago where we staged the history of surrealism in Canada. And
God, tell me all about that.
That was a good fun night.
It was really fun. We've had a lot of fun Canlit events, Greg, for sure. Yeah, I was even thinking about the time that me and a couple people dressed up as the Four Horsemen in your class, complete with mustache and did a performance. Because I mean, actually, one of the things I really like about the Four Horsemen is their scores. I feel like it's like an undervalued, like, you know, thing about sound poetry, right? So they, especially like the season score, is probably the one that people have seen the most, but it looks like a flow chart. It's not even that complicated, it's really interesting to think about thing like sound poetry as kind of like not totally chaos, but like there's a formula and a flow to it. And it's funny, I don't often do sound poetry, but I do have a couple sound poems, and when I perform them, I get so many questions, people being like, what does that look like on the page? Yeah. And like, how do you know what you're doing? And so it's really interesting when you hear like their work Seasons, for instance, and then you see the score of it, and BP has a really lovely essay about like why publish scores of sound poetry, like why, you know, like what do they bring, and how do you visualize something that's so audible? And so I really love that kind of interplay that they have there between the visual, the sound, and how they come together. And it's interesting stuff.
I think that's the really fertile area for me is the ways in which I, you know, I mean, maybe this is obvious to everyone, but the ways in which Canadian experimentalism, I'll say experimentalism in general, but I think what I detect in the stuff that I know about in Canada does tend to foreground both the visual and the sonic elements. Mm-hmm. Or that there are twin sort of streams of thinking about poetry that take the text almost as a third, mm-hmm. tertiary, like less important thing. And that maybe with BP and the Four Horsemen and Bill Bissett, we started with, I hate all these frames, like linear frames, but there's this idea that poetry is a sonic phenomenological thing, right? And it can be dealt with on those terms. And then maybe we can also look at the visual aspect of it as well, separated again from its content or textual sort of semantic meaning.
Yeah.
Let me ask why that is. Is that just an impossible question?
I think it's because of BP, because he's so starkly, you know, between his concrete work and his sonic work, I think you end up with this this kind of moment that makes it easy to kind of separate all the elements.
They really wanted to break down the semantic dominance of language too. Like, we were so locked into the symbolism and the content and the, you think about the Northrop Frye school, thematic elements of language overwhelmed the writing. Mm-hmm. And so on the other hand, you have the Marshall McLuhan school of, you know, erupting in the 50s and 60s, who are all about intermediation mm-hmm. and trying to find crossovers. And what was the term, border blur? Mm-hmm. That comes from England. And McLuhan's big concept that he latched onto was verbico-visual, which is right from Joyce. So they were listening to the stuff that was happening elsewhere. They just got really excited about it, I think. And it's not to say that that stuff wasn't happening elsewhere, but there was an enthusiasm for intermediation that's, you see it in somebody like Bissett or Nicol. The blurring of the boundaries is the point, and trying to animate the material language as opposed to the semantic language is really underscores it all.
Yeah, maybe the question becomes like, how did it get enfranchised? Like, it never felt marginal to me, you know, as I began, like when I began thinking about poetry, like B.B. Nicol was really close to the top. Like, people were, you know, that was just out there. You didn't have to work really hard to, maybe I just got lucky, you know, like, I mean, my tutors are amazing. I still reach for those notebooks sometimes, but, you know.
I have a B.P. Nicol poem tattooed on my arm.
Are you kidding? That's amazing.
Yes. I think it's funny. Like, I, you know, when people ask me, like, you know, who kind of got you started in poetry, like, who are your kind of like early influences? And I have four of them. And, you know, it's BP, it's Bill, it's your Bessé, and it's Dion Brand, yes. Right? And I think, like, and that's where this gets interesting for me, right? And Greg and I have talked about this quite a bit, right? You know, in terms of like what you were talking about, Nasser, like the visual and the like sound, the audible stuff. I think that Nurbessé's work is actually incredibly interesting that way, because, you know, a lot of people read Zong and it's so incredibly oral in how it looks on the page and how it explores the white space and all of that. But until you've actually been to a performance of Zong, I don't know that you've actually read it in the way that you should, because yes. It really just comes alive and it becomes this like incredible ritual that comes alive in sound that has roots in Calypso, but also like Yoruba rituals and stuff like that. And so there's an interesting thing here about like this tie to the Four Horsemen, to B.P. Nicol, to that like legacy, but also like, you know, Claire Harris, like Nurbessé, you know, like the dub poet, Lillian Allen, like there's such a strong Caribbean influence in Canada as well, that creates a really rich visual, experimental, audio poetry that like is really rich. And you know, Greg said earlier about like wanting to kind of, you know, dethrone like the kind of semantic authority, right? And I always tell people that when I think of experimental poetry, I think of it as BZ and AZ, before Zong and after Zong. Because, and I mean that in like in kind of an interesting way, because it's like, you know, I fell in love with B.P. Nichol and Bill and all of these people who were, you know, really radically taking a look at language and being like, how can we unseat this kind of authority play? Like the radicality of play is like so meaningful to me. But there's something different happening when you have like Nurbese, when you have Jordan Abel, when you have all of these experimentalists like dismantling language that was incredibly oppressive. And that's like a tool for survival, right? And so I just think like, you know, I don't think that those two things have to come at loggerheads. I think that they can exist and be really complementary to each other, right? But to me, I'm always thinking doubly when I think of experimentalism in Canada, and I'm always thinking of those two kind of tracks. And there's more tracks. Those are just the two that kind of resonate for me.
I think you're absolutely right. And I also really like thinking about how they grow from each other. I've told this story before, but when I brought Lillian Allen to my class back when I was teaching at University of Toronto as a sessional, I had a picture, a small little picture of BP on my door, and she walked up and gave it a kiss. And I was completely shocked and taken aback by that.
Yeah.
Because I didn't see the connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she told me the connection. She said when she arrived in Canada as a teenager, he was the first one to come up and say, I hear what you're doing, and make a space for her and invite her to readings and give her chapbooks and you know, welcome her to the community.
That's fantastic. And
yeah, it is. And it's important work to think. But for me, the connection is through the long legacies of colonialism, which certainly has affected the Caribbean and the indigenous communities in Canada more than the settler populations. But that's not to say colonialism isn't a problem that we all wrestle with here. And I think those writers were thinking about that. And I think about, you know, like Dennis Lee, he writes that essay about losing language in 72. He just realized that his words were hollow. There was a British side, there was an American side, but there was nothing that was connecting him to where he was. And that was a confrontation with colonialism and structures.
Right.
I'm so glad you got, like that was kind of what I was hoping we'd land on some of these ideas. You know, you guys are just so smart that we got there like instantly. Because it's easy to sort of talk about B.P. Nichol as the center of these things, but I think maybe we're all good at decentering the narrative already. and so we can see that, well, no, actually it is kind of Jordan Abel and rewriting these colonial legacies, and that maybe the mainstream narrative, the kind of canonical narrative about experimentalism in Canada is actually catching up to some of these other ideas that are only showing up now, or, you know, like pre-Zong, but after Zong, you know.
That's an incredibly galvanizing text, because I think Zong, I think Kate is absolutely right. Zong is one of those works that told experimentalists that they should be politically aware and thinking about the kind of structures that their work is participating in and perpetuating. And on the other side, it told politically oriented writers that there's a bigger toolbox that you have to play with. And which one's that?
This one's Apostrophe. It's kind of tangential to sort of think about Apostrophe, Darren Rischler Henry and Bill Kennedy's internet
book.
Piece. It is. It's a great book. But as you speak about Nurbese's, about Zong's sort of political tech, you know, its playbook in terms of or opening up the palette for politics, like, I think Apostrophe is also sort of doing some of that work. Things like that are happening. It's a bit, it's maybe another degree away, but just thinking about the mechanics of writing and the way it's getting shoved around, that's equally prescient, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Darren's so awesome for thinking about interface. He's got interface down. He can just sort of see the levels of mediation in any scenario and make an art out of it. I love that touch.
And that's really not so different from what Nurbasi's talking about, what Philip's talking about in the Notanda section in Zong, mm-hmm. right? Like the language is the interface. And the codes by which Gregson V. Gilbert is operating.
Right.
It's funny to me to see, I never would have thought to put those two together, you know?
Well, they are in the conceptual tradition, right?
But
Nurbasi has a funny line with that.
Yeah, not a fan of it. Well, and I think it's because, like, and I mean, you know, at the risk of being sacrilege, I mean, you know, like, I think there's like an interesting thing when you start talking about B.P. Nichol, right? He's so canonized. I have him on my frickin' arm. We do really, really put B.P. Nichol up on a pedestal in Canada, I feel. And I think—
Did it ever bug you the way, like, some people would really, what did Christian call it? Nicholphilia? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, like it used to bother me, and I.
But it's still away. A subculture, right? It's not like, it's within that subculture. He is, untouchable, unimpeachable.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think that reinforces certain narratives about visual poetry, right? Especially, you know, it's. Like, you know, we just started this conversation talking about visual poetry and lineage and influence, right? And, you know, you don't know how many people assume that I, like, am derivative in some kind of way of B.P. Nichol and Bill Bissett, which I am. But yeah. There's also all of these other women and fantastic practitioners who are not part of that group who have their stakes here. And I just feel like they do get kind of overlooked in terms of experimentalism more often than not. And so I think that has something to do with it. But, you know, in the Notanda, like, Nurbasi does kind of talk a little bit about why she refuses conceptualism. You know, and it has to do with this, you know, she was, for her, like, the experimentalism is not really by choice, like, it's her working with the master's tools, and so she refuses to kind of see it as this language play, and more of, like, a language of survival. And so I think there's, like, a really interesting, we might, as scholars or as readers, put it into that bucket, but again, like, you know, at what cost? Like, you know, like,
I don't want to do any damage by suggesting that, you know, Darren talking about the interface in a work like Apostrophe is on par with the kind of politics that Nurbasi is doing in Zong. But mm-hmm. I think there is something interesting. There is a confluence in there. Like, my spidey sense is tingling here. And I think there's more to look at in those moments, even when, because I love it when poets disavow labels and they're like, oh no, I'm not a, you know, romantic or a conceptualist or whatever. And of course they are at some point.
I'm going even further back here, but there's a, there's an older writer named AJM Smith. And just by even talking about him, I'm setting myself up into a certain positionality here, but he talks about a kaleidoscopic approach to form that happens in Canada where we don't have canon. And so I kind of bristle when you say B.P. Nichol's canonized, because I don't actually feel there is such a thing as a real Canadian canon. I think it's...
I meant saint.
Like, yeah, saint I'll take.
That's
saint
I'll take. Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah.
With a pun on ST somehow.
Yes, exactly, yeah, of course. Exactly. Saint Nichol.
But there's a kaleidoscopic approach to form and canon that's atemporal in Canada. Like, the Americans really feel that line that comes from Thoreau and Longfellow and Melville and where they are in relation to Whitman and Ginsberg, and they feel up to, and Britain's just, you know, that's what they do. They invented that stuff, that sense of a lineage. But in Canada, we don't have that. So you pick and you choose what kind of tools you want. You pick and you choose what kind of lineage you want to create for yourself. And but by doing that, it makes you inherently suspicious of anytime somebody says, well, this is the natural way of doing it, or the natural form, or the best form. And so the interface is always, in a colonial context like Canada, the interface is always somebody else's and never your own. And so you never are a natural inheritor of form.
Yeah.
And so something like Darren Wurschler, his attention to the interface, I think it is connected to what Nurbese is doing, even if the use of that awareness is going in a different direction.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And see, I tied AJM Smith in here. And
I think it's so interesting. I think it's interesting to look back to see where you're going. I think it's interesting to break what has come before to do new things. I think all of these things are really interesting. But you don't know how many times, also because I happened to work with a medium called Letraset that I was working with as a child because my dad owned a shop and like we had it laying around and I would just like pick it up and play with it all the time. You know how many people are like, oh, Derek, you must be derivative of Derek. And I just think like these narratives of derivation, they just don't sit right with me. Do you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I think I don't know that they're entirely helpful. And I am a Duncanian. So he is rolling over in his grave for telling me that I don't like derivation. But like I'm more interested in like the conversations between people, right? Like and I think Danny's politics has a lot to do with this as well. Is like, you know, it's about continuing conversations, like taking, giving, you know, like being in collaboration with people as opposed to this like linear line. And I'm not saying that anyone's proposing the line is linear, but sometimes it feels like that when you're of this generation, like a newer generation who's practicing these forms, that you're like, oh, you're straight out of Beaulieu's camp or straight out of Nichols' camp, or do you know? And I just think it becomes quite limiting because then you're always being compared to that. Right, and you can't really just like do your thing and then not have it be in that bucket, you
yeah
know?
So you can't pick up a typewriter without somebody
comparing you
to BB Nickel or
Saint Nickel, I think.
Saint Nickel.
At
the altar of but I think maybe is it fair to say that we have a pretty healthy disrespect for our forebears?
And amnesia too. Subcultures have their icons and texts, which need to be articulated and remembered. So it is a question of how do we remind ourselves of where we come from while also allowing room for new spaces to open up and new voices and new implications.
Yeah,
that's a funny part of any conversation, right?
Yes.
You hear if people spend all their time saying, but, oh, we were just talking about that, as opposed to what are you actually doing that's new.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm holding Foundry in my hands, you know. This is one of the for your listeners, obviously, Anthony and Clara, they won't see me waving this around, but Gregory Betts is the latest thing, right? Sweet Form was like a couple months before this.
That's right.
I've been watching you. but you know, tell us about Foundry. I think this is one of my favorite books in a long time.
It's so good.
It's so good. And I see many tattoos in here, basically. You
know? It has. It is. There's an artist down in Windsor who is a gumball machine that will have tattoos from Foundry.
Why does the gumball machine always follow you, Greg?
I know.
I feel like every time I talk to you, a gumball machine makes its way into the conversation.
And it's in Windsor? This is epic. Okay, I'm going to send people.
Unfortunately, they're temporary tattoos because you can't put the real tattoos in a gumball machine.
Yeah.
But
they frown upon that, apparently.
But my guy could probably use it as a template to put one on me, right?
Right.
That would work.
So Foundry is one of those projects where I discovered somebody else's work and it and it spoke to me in a way that opened up an avenue of exploration. Obviously, I've been deeply interested and invested in visual poetry in various forms for as long as I've been a writer. But this one came from the Letterpress Archive in the United States, posting a link to an odd book that they had uncovered from 1942. The Gujarati Type Foundry released a catalog in the middle of the Second World War. I have not been able to track down much information about the foundry. They don't exist anymore as a company. They, as far as I can tell, they stopped working during the Second World War, but they released a catalog for businesses. It's very corporate. They've got all these little slogans, you know, how to win over your customers. and they used their typeface to do this, and they created all kinds of new fonts and typefaces for the project, which they would illustrate with these amazing essays, like the history of the swastika, illustrate a new typeface in the middle of the Second World War. And they weren't doing it from the British perspective or the German perspective, they were doing it from the Indian perspective and looking at the history there. Well, they had one typeface in there, which I found very beautiful, which was the Mita typeface, and it was after the 15th century poet. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, what are business guys doing with this poet? They're using him. They had created a font that was multiform, that had 32 different root pieces that created all the different letters. Mm-hmm. And so it was a recombinant typeface. And now we're getting into my zone. I was like, recombinant forms, that's starting to be getting into the anagram and reusing. But the more I looked into the poet, the more it seemed to resonate. He was somebody who believed in broken pieces and reusing broken pieces and using that as a pathway to the beautiful. In his case, Shiva was the figure that he met in the peak of his brokenness.
So the elephant poem.
The elephant poem.
Well, that's a Ganesha kind of reference, I guess. But
yeah,
it's such a beautiful book. Like, but there's like a BP reference, you know, at least one, right?
That's right.
And it's the kind of forward push meets backwards look. I think is so beautifully and respectfully done in this book. I just want to tell everyone to go out and get a copy of it. Red Fox Press. I hope they have lots of copies because everyone should have this book. But yeah, Kate, have you seen it yet?
I don't have it in the flesh, but I have seen it. Yes, it's in. Yes.
And Kate knows about Red Fox Press because this is one of those spaces like Pentarac Press that is not just doing a specific thing, but is doing it in an international context and is creating, it's becoming a nexus point for an investigation of material language. And they're really open to Canadians. So,
yeah. Yes.
So we flood them when they open those doors.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they do lovely work. Yes.
That's what I was trying to say earlier too, is that it's the material language thing, like that BP, Bill Bissett, open up the space for thinking about the sonic materiality and the visual materiality, which, you know, like Lang Po in the States does in the 80s, but they're still, I think they're still thinking about it as text.
And it's not as immediately available. The Lang Po stuff is amazing work. It's some of my favorite work, but it's hard, right? Like whereas you can pick up a BP Nickel poem and you have an easy access point. It's right there on the surface. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of lets you, it invites you into its negotiation with theory. Mm-hmm. As opposed to saying, you need to know the theory before you can even start here.
Oh, you're Schreiner, P. Inman, Pekoa. Oh man, that's, you know. And like McCaffrey's kind of on the line with those guys.
Oh yeah. Too,
so like, yeah. I don't mind. That's the only way I can sort of figure out LangPub, but yeah, it's a much more accessible materiality.
In it also like doesn't take itself seriously, and I like, you know, like there's, I like, I always have like poetry that I'll go to for different moods or whatever, and like when I need to just like get out of my head and just like be light and fun, like I always pick up BP because like it is that, right? Like it's, yeah, like it's no wonder like he like wrote for Fraggle Rock, like it's, you know, like it's just like it's super like light and fun. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a radical, you know, like underpinning to it or like some politics to it, but it's just, it's not taking itself too seriously. And as Greg said, it invites, what how would he say it? It invites as many entrances and exits as possible, right? Yeah. And so and I love that. I feel like it is really inviting, and I think that's consistent like with him as a person, and as, you know, as much as we hear it from others. And so I think there's definitely that side of things that people, you know, kind of like about him. But yeah, I would agree with that. There's a, yeah, he's my mood lifter poet.
So what's changed recently? I mean, like it has gone from a kind of subculture to maybe now pressing out into further spaces. I mean, Nervous is not part of that. Her mm-hmm. book sold very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
What yeah. do you account for that?
Actually, before we get onto this, just so we can trace the just so we can trace the history. And I'm meant to be hosting this, and I haven't said anything about it, which is because you're all being so fascinating. But also, I'd like to know, because I have a question. So, what changed in Canada with at the turn of the century with the conceptualists? Because it seems like a lot of these things were bubbling away with people like BP. So was conceptualism more of a revolution or a natural progression? I don't know who wants to answer that.
Or it really depends who you ask.
Yeah. You know, you're going to get in a lot of trouble if you start throwing too many. But like, I mean, wouldn't like Christian and Darren and Kenny sort of claim it as, you know, their movement based on some chicken wings in Buffalo or something like that back in 2003? You know, I'm sure that was glib and you know, deliberately so by them, but you know, that it doesn't hurt when you have people grabbing headlines. And a couple of, you know, like maybe the next major stop is Unoya.
Unoya was huge because yeah. it won the Griffin, which was the first major award since, I mean, how far back do you go? For an experimental text to win a major award, Nickel and Ondaatje got it in 72.
Yeah.
They won the Governor General's Award. They split it, and then they said we're never doing that again when it became a controversy in the House of Commons. But yeah, there's no disputing the prominence of Unoya, for better or for worse. I mean, it annoyed people and spurred them into action, I think. And it certainly introduced another tool. Nobody can do univocalic lipograms in Canada ever again, though, right? I mean, that's been done, and it becomes like a limit case that's been solved, and so now we push on to other ones. I'd be interested to hear how somebody like Duncan fits into the conceptual art wave, because he was a collage guy, right? Back with Jess Collins and all that. And that's sort of right on the edge of the early conceptual art world that comes out of Black Mountain, and they're all tied in there.
Sure.
And so conceptual writing has a longer history in its connection to the visual art world. And it certainly came to a head with the Kenny, Christian, Darren, Craig, Vanessa, Fitterman, who am I missing in that lineage?
I think you named most of the big hitters.
That's right.
Case, you know, Flarf, then, you know, sort of, you know, so you've got Case on Muhammad, and
I love his work. He's fantastic. Yeah, he got a 2-page spread in the Toronto Star, I remember.
Nice.
Which was very impressive.
And there's, yeah, a lot of sort of kicking over the traces at that point. I think I've lost track of the line of inquiry that Anthony was trying to push us down.
But what impact did conceptualism have on this? I think they would claim, Kenny in his most recent book says Ubu had a large role in bringing back concrete poetry. But I think it goes the other way, which is that Ubu is connected to the internet, and the internet gives us a new visuality and iconography. And so they might be separate things, but they're certainly overlapping.
Well, and then we find BP again, because you put together, you know, the BP Nickel archive for us, you know, Gregory, saving generations of scholars, you know, a lot of time. And we get to see things like his computer poem, the name of which is escaping me right now. What was BP's?
Oh, Jesus.
This is so embarrassing. First Orders? No, that's not right.
The computer poem?
Yeah, yeah. He had this lovely little basic program, and it would, and the words would float by. It was kind of, you know, early
first screening.
First screening. That's it. Yes. Thank you. We're too smart. We have too many things on our mind. You know, and you know, obviously from there you go to Brian Kim Steffens, you know, Dream Life of Letters, and we're watching the dematerialize.
Did you know BP Nickel has an earlier computer poem?
No, come on. Really?
That was his work from 82, 83. But back in 1968. This is the stuff that I could talk about. Earl Burney came from Vancouver to do a writer in residence at the University of Western Ontario. And they had just bought a computer, and it was a big front page news in Canada that they bought a computer, because they got one of those big, massive supercomputers, and they were trying to figure out what to do with it. And Burney was there. And so he and BP started playing around, and they did a recombinant sonnet. They fed into the computer dozens of sonnets, right, and it spat out a whole series of experimental recombined permutations on it.
So it's apostrophe. It's apostrophe. It's Queno. It's a computer poem on, like, obviously on code card, on like punch cards.
Geisen, Ian Somerville, all that stuff.
Oh, unbelievable. These guys.
And Earl Burney, who's an Anglo-Saxon scholar, classical.
I guess we can say it then. The Canadians are always already sort of an experimental kind of breed. That's fantastic.
I knew
if Earl Burney's in there. Yeah, if Earl's in there, my days.
Yeah.
That's so fun. Are those poems available, Greg?
Yes. Oh, man. I put it up on bpnickel.ca.
Is it there? Okay, good. I haven't seen much to my discredit.
There's remarkable stuff there. So when you ask about conceptualism, I love the work that's happening here, because it really foregrounds and thinks about form. It foregrounds form and thinks about form and insists and ushers a kind of challenge to people to say, take it further, go make it smarter, take it deeper, go to the end, the limit cases, and see what you can find. Mm. I also don't think it's wholly original. I think it's part of a long movement of art, and they've laid claim to a title, which is an awesome name for a movement, frankly. And you know, credit where credit is due. It's the new Fluxus, the new Situationist International. It's got a nice ring to it, and it builds on a tradition. Does it actually announce a new shift in how writing is made? Maybe it made it easier. Maybe Christian's success with Eunoia gave people permission to bring form back into their writing.
Mm.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'm always heartened. I think it was Charles Bernstein who said something along the lines of the poem, the contemporary poet is just trying to find the form that the poem underhand, basically. I'm paraphrasing badly here, but, you know, whatever poem you're working on, you're just trying to find the form for that poem, you know, in a kind of bespoke way, poem per poem. Yeah, that's a terrible paraphrase, but that's kind of the idea, as I recall.
I think like going back to what I was saying earlier too, I think it made us more conscious of how we handle poetic materials and the dangers therein, right? Speaking specifically about Kenny and about Vanessa, like, and about what, you know, like how, like the appropriation of those materials and how they're used and just like how that gets complicated, right? And that there's, you know, poets being poets, can we just claim things willy-nilly? Or is there a reverence to be had? And again, it ties back into like conversations with Nerpasse, because, you know, there's been people who have taken her work and have not really followed like protocols of care and ethics around like the sanctity of what she's doing and the voices that she's writing about. And so, I mean, conceptualism for me, like that really stands out, is like the conversations we were all having around how to use poetic materials and the respect that we need to have for them.
Yeah, you know, that's probably what makes it hardest to be a conceptualist these days, you know, because I think it, for some people, I'll quote or paraphrase Bernstein again, I think he said movements are for people who haven't read all the poems. You know, so like when people talk about conceptualism and appropriation, and the idea that, oh yeah, it's just a grabbing of, you know, cutting and pasting whatever you find, and in bad cases it can look like that, but I think what Kate's speaking to, and I certainly am conscious of myself, is the ethics, the appropriateness of the appropriation, like. Mm. You know, we do have to think about it. It's not as inert as maybe some of the first wave of people in this game thought it was, you know?
And maybe that's a really interesting thing to think through in terms of that long history too. From the, you know, the old Clement Greenberg avant-garde autonomy.
Yeah.
That a lot of people had a reaction to it when he was proposing that. And it's the same kind of reaction that Kenny Goldsmith was receiving when he was claiming the same kind of detachment space for art, that it was a pure zone that had no polis ties. But
which is completely untrue. Like, I mean, it just can't be that, right? If the language is going to have purchase.
Well, it can't be a material thing and be an immaterial thing at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
And when it's a material thing, we recognize it as having affect as well as effect, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And it's really, maybe that might be the best definition of a poet, is someone who's conscious of both of those things kind of simultaneously.
Yes.
The affect and the effect. Gosh, we should just hang it up now, right? That's it.
Mic drop.
We can go home now. No,
we are home.
Yeah. We nailed it. Oh no. Brazilian.
So okay. So that seems like it certainly reinvigorated that style of poetry and brought some more attention to it. Where does that leave Canadian poetry now? Because Clara and I just see this side of Canadian poetry. We're missing out on other cultures there. So just how impactful is experimental poetry in Canada now compared with the more mainstream styles?
Well, I mean, is Dionne Brandt an experimental writer? Because, you know, she's bringing home.
She certainly is with her. She certainly is with prose. You would call her a poetic style of prose, Her poetry is so good.
The Blue Clerk has quite a bit of experimentation too. And oh God, that book like haunts me on the daily. So good. Like,
I just got it. I'm so behind on that.
I'm jealous that you're like
cracking it. You know,
I reviewed it with your book.
Yes, you did. I know, but who has time to read, right?
I handed that to you on a platter. here's the book that you need to read.
You have to kind of, I have to cleanse my palate of everybody else's ideas about a book before I read it, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But I'm a huge fan of Jordan Abel. I'm a huge fan of Ian Williams. If you haven't read Word Problems, I'm just plugging him now. Mm-hmm. But my goodness, Word Problems is just that's a book for our times, I think, without overstating it too much. And it's beautifully experimental.
And he's mainstream.
He
gets in Maclean's magazine.
Yeah.
Which is my definition of mainstream. Yeah.
that's Canada mainstream. Oh, that's so funny. I've been gone for too long. That's great.
Maclean's. Most publications you can sneak into and there's back doors. Yeah. Maclean's has no back door. It's you're either there or you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could draw a line between some of the work in Foundry and some of the work in Word Problems, typographically speaking, in terms of layout.
You could draw a line between them because this book is never going to get an award in Canada.
Wow.
And it wouldn't, it doesn't have, there's no space. B.P. Nichol chapbook is the closest thing that would be available to it. Whereas his book will be nominated for the GG. It will be nominated for the Griffin. And it will be
long-listed for the Suster, I think I just saw.
Is that right? I saw that list come out.
Yesterday or today or something.
Yeah.
So
how mainstream is this right now? I don't think that there's much. I don't think there's a real barrier if a book is really well done at this point, and well marketed. I don't think there's boundaries by form at this point.
Mm. Agreed.
And if it's done really well, like Place of Scraps I still go back to that book. I think that's one of those books for our time. I sing its praises constantly. People are probably tired of me singing. but it is that perfect marriage of form and content. And that's by Jordan Abel. It's one of those books that didn't find a ceiling. It went up and it just kept going and going. And now it's, reprinted and in the classrooms all across the country. So, so is experimental writing set aside? I don't feel like that. At the same time, the stuff that we're doing doesn't touch the market of the popular novel,
right?
Or Rupi Kaur. Right.
Well, Rupi's she's looking down at us from Mars going.
Although it was a pretty big moment when Sasha Archer's Mother's Milk was on the CBC Books, a book from Tim Glassett and on Stamp Poetry, it gave us visceral poets. Did I just mix visceral and visual? I think I might have.
That's great.
It's very apropos for that book. But that was really neat to see that on the CBC.
That was Derek's list, right?
But then it was, I think it also got picked up separately. And I saw it on a CBC list and I was like, wow, that's really interesting. Mm. And so it's I think it opens the doors for a lot of the work to happen. I even think of Kai Kellow's work too, right? I think he is one of the entryways for us experimentalists in some ways to have a little bit more of a mainstream audience as well too, or at least shine some light on some more experimental works, right? Magnetic Equator is just I can't even wrap my head around that book, and I've read it two or three times. I'm still lost at sea with it, but it's just a stunning book, and it has some of the things that we've been a lot of the things that we've been talking about in terms of experimentation, history, form, place, identity, and it's getting a lot of good attention too, aside from the Griffin. So it's interesting.
He's a great example because he's somebody who also has no ceiling. He's on the cover of Quill and Quire. That's not quite Maclean's, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
But I think it's funny because I'm not in Canada. It's been a while. since I've been gone to, yeah, so like Quillen Choir and McLean's and things like that. But from from out here, 20 years, almost 20 years now, being away from Canada and looking, being able to see it from the UK, it looks to me like a very open and welcoming space for new forms of writing, you know.
That's because you're in the UK.
yeah, it is.
Grass is always greener.
Yeah, perhaps. Well,
Kate mentions Sasha Archer's book getting the attention it did. It's just one in a long line of these things I'm seeing where I wish I were Canadian. You know, Jordan Abel and Christian Book both winning the Griffin Prize. I see so many things that I just can't imagine happening over here. And I think NASA could perhaps back me up on this.
Yeah, I guess so. But you know, like, I mean, how far does the recognition get you guys, Kate, Greg? You know, I mean,
huge. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
You go to the farmers market, and they're like, right? Banana. Right?
Yeah, like, I don't think we're writing. I don't think any
5 for 12.
Yeah.
15.
No one's doing it for the recognition, right? Like, I don't think people are doing it for the prizes.
Not doing it for the money, are we?
Yeah, I'm not.
Well, as much as you say, like, Anthony, like, that you're, you know, you're always looking to, like, what's going on in Canada or whatever, but for poets like me, like, it's like, no one in Canada will publish our full color works. And right. So we always go to you guys to publish that stuff. And, you know, and I think, like, yeah, like it's interesting to think about mainstream or not, or like, you know, I mean, especially from a small press angle, because, you know, there are people who I've talked to who'd be like, oh, you need to get a Canadian publication because, you know, it's going to mean this and this for grants and that for grants. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. I just like want, like, I'm fortunate enough to like not have to work with grants, but like, I also like, I like working with the publishers I like working with, you know, and that means a lot more to me. And just doing the writing means a lot to me. In and of itself. And that might be an unpopular opinion, but like, you know, like I had a really rich conversation actually like with Norbessie the other day about this, about like, you know, and Greg, we've kind of talked about this too, about there's something that happens in the moment of creating, especially when you're creating with your hands, that disappears once that act is over. And I think about that, right? And if that invites other people in, then like wonderful. But so much depends on the act of creation and being in that moment. And so like, I don't really care about the recognition. If y'all like it, it's great. Yeah. But you know, like it's not really like the main driver. And I think that has a lot to do with the poetry that I practice, you know, in particular. But yeah, so I think there's a lot going on there. But I would just like to add Poem Atlas and Astra Papakristodoulou to your UK, as well as the lovely Ladies of the Crested Tit, who are no longer, but published this fantastic anthology, Rewilding.
Yeah, everyone's got props. I've got no props. I'm just gonna bring my props.
You know, the props are lovely, but we are an audio. I know we're all looking at each other now, but
yes,
you know, you'll have to send us links of anything yes. worthwhile of plugging to include.
Yes.
We should do a podcast where it's just people holding things up to a camera and no one
describing them.
That's fantastic. I think there's lots of stuff going on in the UK, and I'm certainly envious of the work that's happening there. And part of it is because it flares up in these little moments like Pentarac Press. The other thing that's worth bearing in mind is that Canada is the size of a continent, right? And so you're bumping into the writers through the internet, filtered down to one word, Canada, but it's not one word. It's a thousand nations strung out across an enormous land. And there's pockets of activity all over the place, but they all kind of coalesce into one channel, as it were. So Derek is very far away. Darren is very far away.
The other way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Franco Cortese is just around the corner, mind you.
Yeah.
So there is stuff happening. Adam Dickinson is just around the corner, and Kate's not so far.
Down the road,
just down the road,
a couple hours.
Yeah,
but like, you know, I'm watching. You can watch. It's so funny watching things unfold on Twitter. For instance, like Sasha and Gary Barwin and everyone are playing with stamps right now and doing, you know, and Greg, you're in there too, right? You've thrown a few.
I took it to a deep dream generator. That was my contribution.
Yeah.
And you see these, but these little really lovely sort of effervescent, you know, perhaps unpublishable, but still beautiful pieces of work.
That's pure conversation as far as I can see.
Yeah.
And that's sort of thinking about language as part of this communication medium and art participating in that.
It's a conversation for you, but it's a gallery for people outside, right? Like it really is. You could, that's easily framed, you know, all of those things could be put together. It would not look bad by any stretch.
The best thing about Twitter is that everybody thinks they can join in. And the worst thing about Twitter is that everybody thinks they can join in.
Everybody does join in.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we have to talk about the last time all of us were physically together, 2 years ago. I'll leave it to you to explain it. This is your gig.
About the arm wrestle?
If you like.
Because we're not repeating that. That's not happening.
The long history of Canadian literature there.
You know? Was that the end or beginning of conceptual arm wrestling? that was a very special moment. And I have to say, for that conference in Dublin, we flew over 145 Canadians for that one. And coordinated the flights and schedules and of everything. And that was significantly easier than the conference I'm organizing right now.
Really?
Significantly. Well, the ease with which the five of us were able to meet in Dublin so many impossible worlds ago.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Speaks to the complexity of this of the moment that we're into now. Mm-hmm. I really loved being able to see everybody in a room together gathered, and it felt like a gathering. And it was an echo of an event that happened in 2014 in St. Catharines at Prague. A lot of the same people were coming back as sort of a status update, but it was a much wider, smarter circle, I thought, that came back. And people had grown, and it was wonderful to see. The moment had so many iconic situations. The one that sticks out for me is Joshua Whitehead. He gave a talk, one of the keynote addresses at the National Library in Ireland. And it was the first time an Indigenous person had spoken at the National Library in Ireland. And we went from there, we went to the main gallery room, the rotunda, I guess. And that was, you know, where Yeats had done all the research for his modernist poems. And Jordan Abel stood up and read, and Ian Williams read, and Liz Howard read, and Christian Book read. It was a moment where there was just a huge reception. It felt significant. And there was experimental poetry in Canada, out of Canada, in the world, in a beautiful meeting space, in it where writing itself, modern writing itself, had been invented. Just fantastic.
It felt like such a bridge, you know, like that's how it, like I, there's so many connections and relationships that have like fortified for me, like since being in Dublin, like when, especially with like Kimberly Campanello, right? Like she's been, she's a part of Judith. She's a part of the Jacket 2 feature. Like her and I have had like a correspondence, and like her work is phenomenal. Clara and Anthony, like meeting you both there was just so lovely, you know, and just like all of these moments in time that have bridged, you know, like the pond, so to speak. And yeah, like I still have so many rich memories, but also just like rich relationships that have grown since then.
Yeah. I came to it not knowing what to expect. Really, you know, of course, always happy to like sort of go and talk about my work and about, like, you know, because I'm an egotist, but you know, but I remember the first session, and it was you, Greg, Lillian, and Gary, did a piece. Adina, I think Adina Karasik also read from her work.
Peter Yeager as well.
And Peter Yeager, yeah, gives a piece from Midamble, I think. And I remember sitting there thinking, I've been to entire conferences where this would have been like the key, this would have been three keynotes in a row. Mm. This could have, you know, and it was 10 in the morning on the first day. And I
just getting warmed up.
Yeah. And it just kept sort of rolling outward from there. You know, but I gotten my money's worth in the first session. It was completely unbelievable.
I love those confluence moments where chance creates really important galvanizing moments. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite moments was Anne Enright, who was a colleague at UCD. I think of her now as kind of like the Margaret Atwood of Ireland. She gave me her office for the conference because she had a really nice, comfortable couch in it. She said, and she, of course, she had the nicest office, right? Closest to the department and all that. And I snuck away there. I was just to have a calm moment after things were so frantic and running around. And I turned a corner to go right into her office. And there was Kai Collot and Lillian Allen in a chat. And they said, come on over and have a conversation. And I was thinking, oh my God, like this moment can happen. And that's what conferences are really for. I was trying to get away, and instead I arrived exactly where I really needed to be. And that's, I hope we get back to that. I miss that. I miss people.
I need people to travel too, otherwise my book's dead. So, you know, let's have it all. You know, I was going to say, like, the thing I wanted to ask you guys anyway while you were here was, like, I don't know if there's time, this might be a huge can of worms, but, like, I'm trying to get away from, do you ever try and get away from form, from highly wrought, you know, formal works? I'm noticing.
I don't.
Anthony, you can't. You're exempt from that. Yeah. Question. You drill harder, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Right? I sometimes try to guess your mood, Anthony, based on like the rigor of your constraints. I'm like, oh, Anthony's having an existential crisis. That lip is really tightly wound.
Yeah, he's taking it real easy.
Well,
yeah.
Oh,
it's only a double acrostic. He's
yeah, exactly. You know, like, having a light day. You know?
Yeah. Now, so do you feel like you can get out of form?
I don't know. I'm getting tired of like thinking about like extreme restrictions and I'm working on stuff with it. I've just not. Like now, for me, like the most avant-garde thing I can be doing right now is to just do like regular free verse. Mm-hmm. You know, like does that moment ever come for you guys, or is, you know, like it's just a way. I'm just worried about the sort of pigeonhole of you know, avant-gardism or conceptualism or experimentalism. You know, and do you feel trapped by it?
I've been writing poems about animals in Canada, so that's right. My release. I don't know that those will ever come out. some of us have affections with animals.
I've just been doing straight love poems, you know, just to see if I can, right? And do so without cliche or, you know, mawkishness, right?
The conceptualists used to say, you know, things like, is it time to end the love poem? Mm-hmm. And that's a provocation that I think is not helpful in this world.
Thank you. So glad you said that, man.
That we still, there is still a communication element. Mm-hmm. And it's, maybe it's a pendulum that you swing from formal extremism because all of a sudden people have stopped paying attention to form and have started getting lost in the things that they're saying and forgot about the interface, and in which case you need to rebalance it by pulling it in the other direction. And that probably needs to happen on an individual level on a constant basis too.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that like I learned, especially from Gary Barwin, is like this kind of daily practice of writing without any intention. And that has been incredibly helpful for that pigeonholing feeling. He actually, like, for the last couple of months too, every 2 weeks, like a bunch of people led by Gary, we get together and we just play language games and we just like get out of our head and just like have fun. And not try to be serious and not try to have an intention or like an end goal, but just like play around. And like those have just been incredibly enriching in terms of getting out of your head and just like having fun. Like that should be a thing that we're doing with poems and like not getting too, you know? But it's funny. Yeah. Like I think I totally hear you, because I almost feel sometimes when I actually use words, I'm like, oh my God, I'm such an imposter. Like people I think primarily, like, not that I am in any way recognizable as a poet, but I think people do see me as like a visual poet if they do see my work. And so I'm always kind of interested in how like traversing that gap seems like a gulf. And I'm always like, am I trafficking in signs that are not my own, as fucking Olson would say? Like, you know what I mean? Do I belong here? Is it any good? And like, am I going to write a damn thing in my life that's going to be worthwhile again? Like, I'm at that point where I've like just finished a book of visual poetry and I'm just like, is that it? That's it for me. I think that's it. There's nothing more.
So I think most writers can relate to that feeling of after finishing something saying, I'm done, I'm out of ideas.
Yeah, that's like it. Yeah. And that's all she wrote.
Yeah.
But those games and like, I think finding those spaces, Nasser, like to like get out of your head with other writers and really just collaborate and have fun are critical to my like health, like my mental health as a writer. And I think also my creative health in terms of getting out of the boxes that we kind of sometimes put ourselves in.
That's what that is the conclusion I've reached as well. I was just curious to know how, you know, because you guys, it would be easy to sort of, pigeonhole. You know, everyone in this conversation, probably most of your listeners, Anthony, you know.
I'll say one more thing though. I feel like I was too dismissive saying, I never worry about it. I feel like there are two sides of me, and I yo-yo between them. The part of me that wants to make the most constrained thing ever, just stick another constraint in there, you know, keep going. See how many constraints I can do at once, and let the language just fall apart under these constraints.
Right.
And then the other half of the time, I hate that, and I just want to choose one constraint and write something as lyrical as possible given that one constraint.
Yeah.
And I think I'm sticking with it just because I can flip from one state to the other. Mm. I wouldn't be able to cope just doing the one.
Right.
Either one of those extremes. Mm. So in my own way, that's like doing constraint work and free verse. It's just that the free verse is still constrained.
your poems, especially, I'm thinking of Solemn right now, that trio of lipo, palindromes, and then what did you call them? Consonant palindromes or vowel? But those are beautiful. I mean, they're very expressive works. Like they talk about, they're filled with affect, if you will.
Yeah, that would lean more towards the lyrical side, but I've sent you a copy of my Utu sonnets.
I can do it now. There we go. I can do a prop. See, I can do that now.
A prop.
Finally, a prop that I can pull in. I've got a beer on my desk right beside me.
Yeah, that would be more towards the extreme constraints, so that you read them and they're nonsense. Hopefully, appealing nonsense, but there's no. There's no expression in there.
Some of my best friends are Lunarians, so
that's hilarious.
Can you see the Lunarian sunset in the back there?
No, is it a visit?
Yeah, it's called Lunarian sunset.
Oh.
Brilliant. Again, not conducive to podcasts, but there is a picture in Kate's background of one of Bill Bissett's paintings called Lunarian Sunset, featuring Lunarian orange.
I kind of wish you'd flipped over to a computer voice and done that.
Yeah, that was my best computer voice, Greg. I was trying. It's interesting. I always wondered that, Anthony, about you, like in terms of, geez, like, you know, you put things under so much pressure, like it's got to crack at a certain point, right? Like, what's the break for you? Like, what does that look like? And do you ever kind of get to that point where, you know, you just kind of let things fall apart, like, as you say, and be okay with that? Or is it just like every fiber of your being is just going to ring tighter and tighter until you get that that diamond, you know?
But there's a point where you get so far into piling on the constraints that you know that the result's not going to make sense because it can't, because you've got so many rules. And that's kind of liberating.
Yeah.
But then I feel bad because it's not lyrical. And at heart, I do like lyrical. You know, I think we, NASA, we talked about this last time you were on the podcast, that ultimately, despite all the stuff we do, we do still like what's nice about poetry to begin with. We still like all the typical things, the traditional things that appeal to people with poems.
Yeah, maybe it's all a big experiment in terms of finding this kind of elusive poetic value, you know, whatever that is.
Well, right? you know, you have this moment, which we've been spared to a certain extent right now, where you have to stand in front of a room full of people and read the poems.
Yes.
And if you're spending 9/10 of the time explaining the concept, I bumped into this with if language all the time, because most of the poems in there are useless as expressive things, but the idea is pretty fun. So I would end up just sort of talking about the idea, and then they'd say, well, are you ever going to read the poem? And then say, I don't really actually want to anymore.
But, you know, you find that happens even in what I'll call like a trad poetry reading, where the, you know, august person or not, you know, it's all just paratext. So I was sitting in a cafe in, you know, Leningrad or whatever, you know, and you know, and you just get the story of the poem for 3.5 minutes before the poem arrives. Mm-hmm. And that, how is that very different, I wonder, from some of the things I've seen in terms of experimental or constraint-based stuff, you know? Except the constraint-based writers can be a lot more efficient about it. They're just like, I did this, you know, like
I'm thinking about the River Run reading that we did at Poetry House in Dublin. And I think you got up, you did your reading, and it was extremely affective and effective. People were cheering. It was an exciting moment. And yet it was extremely constrained. It was it's pure form in its way, right?
And that comes from like a long history of performance. Like, because I was like a slam poet like for years, you know, that's where I cut my teeth. And being a performer, you sort of learn how to, you know, it's important to sort of hook your crowd really quick and to use your voice. Yeah, you got to use your voice and get the idea across in an efficient way. So like, I like to sort of pull from both this highly rigorous kind of mode, but also this, you know, Whitmanic or Ginsbergian kind of mode as well. I don't, you know.
Big voice.
Yeah, you gotta have a big voice. You gotta go for it. You know, old sonic even sometimes, whatever, you know, like I just worry sometimes about us as a tribe, perhaps, and that sometimes we, I don't think that's actually true. Maybe it's just lockdown talking, but you know, that we might forget some of the fun and the play that Kate was talking about. You know, that's so sustaining and wonderful about this work.
I think at the point in which I am doing something and I don't find it fun, I just probably won't do it.
Yeah.
You know, like I think, yeah, like I, you know, my time is limited. So if I do things that I find enjoyable or whatever, you know, but I hear what you mean about like it's interesting, right? Like when people come to expect certain things of you and your work, right? And just kind of like trying to get out of that for your own creative freedom and expression and like growth, right? And also like, but also it's safe, isn't it? In some kind of way too. And we like that. And so but I just think, yeah, having those kind of daily moments of writing joy are really, really productive in a non-productive way. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like they're anti-productive. Yes. And I think that's the part, that's the point, right? So they've been really helpful, but yeah, I see what you mean. It's interesting.
I guess it's the idea that even if you're just, for want of a better word, doodling, playing with new things, it's better than nothing. Yeah. And I know I'm really bad at this, but it's that thing, isn't it? If you pick up a pen and something doesn't work, try something else. You know, do something even completely different. Pick up some stamps and have a go at stamp making, or try and write a sonnet. Or...
And never feel bad if you're not producing as much as Gary Barwin.
or Gregory Betts.
Or Gregory Betts.
But that's a good point, right? Which is like, I think as poets, like I struggle with this too, is like, I think that we're like hardwired to be like, is this publishable? Can I publish? Like the will to publish is strong. And I think we need to get out of that. You know, like Danny and I were talking about the other day, we're like, do you want to just go into the forest, write poems and burn them together, like, and have no one else see them? And we're like, yes, because, you know, because I think it actually fosters a culture of like the speed at which we write. And it's like, okay, yeah, that person did that thing, moving along, what's next? Like, it just, it's rapid, isn't it? And like social media has like contributed to that. And I think that that's a bit damaging as a mentality, right? It doesn't allow us like time to pause and experience joy and, God forbid, experiment outside of the things we're used to as poets, because we're like, what's the next thing we're going to produce? But it also puts like really like, you know, unwieldy pressures on us to continue to like, okay, what's next? Oh, I publish a book, okay, what's next? Like, you know, and not have like time to even enjoy the stuff that we put out and have it be in conversation, right? And so I think there's a lot about that kind of culture, especially on Twitter and stuff, that is like not great that way.
Yeah. And I think the pandemic is amplifying this feeling. Cause I know we felt it, like, because there's nothing else to do, you just see everything as work. I can't go out and have fun. I can't. So I'm not saying that the work isn't fun, but I'm just going to work. And you almost don't give yourself a break because I can't do anything else. I should be creating, I should be publishing, I should be doing these things.
Oh yeah.
The office has come home and now it stares at you all day long.
Now we're all sort of sleeping in our offices, you know, which is just so dangerous. But
I love the idea of destroying the poem that you just created though, Kate.
That's magnificent. More just destroying or like creating things because of that and not, you know, because of something else. Or
BP and Steve did it. They would read a poem and the other guy would light it, you know, as he was reading it.
That's amazing.
Been there.
My favorite story from those guys. Well, one of my favorite stories, it was a psychedelic day that they did up at, I think it was Dudney's Cottage.
Right.
And McCaffrey was in the second floor with a typewriter on a scroll, typing like a madman. The text was coming out the window down, and they pulled it across the lawn as he's typing like a madman out into the water and then letting the ink disappear from the page until it was completely erased.
Perfect.
That's great.
More of that.
More of that. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm very into the disposable stuff these days, for sure.
Mm-hmm. But you don't need psychedelics, kids. That's the bottom line. That's
you don't need them.
You don't need them. And work on your and maintain your work-life balance. That's the other, you know, the other good takeaway from this. Don't feel like you have to be at it all the time.
Yes.
I want to go back to something Kate said. It got me thinking about something that's been on my mind lately anyway. Are there too many books being published now? Too many poetry books?
I mean, yeah, Sorry.
You've got your publisher hat on, Anthony. Yeah, I'm here.
Like, yeah. Yeah, and you're not.
Oh, competing. Is this what publishers think? But poets.
But if your books aren't the same,
yeah.
Right? Like if the books you publish are too similar, then yes, you are competing with yourself. But if you are broad in your practice and you know, treating it as like a kind of, I don't know, mode of research or you know, a query or part of a conversation, as Greg says, then no, I think there's really no ceiling on it. And that's where I think conceptualists, experimentalists might have an advantage, because if you're just building these like neat machines that crank out the work, you know, you can offload some of the labor that you know, lyricism in a romantic concept might, you know, in a romantic frame might suggest you have, you know, the writer has to sweat over their work or something like that. But no, I don't think there's too many books being published. There's not enough people reading them. You know, like
maybe. I think I was speaking out of publisher fear.
Yeah.
And I think that fear was probably motivated by the fact there aren't enough readers.
Well, you know, I quiz my students about it because, like, they all say, oh, I don't understand poetry or I hate poetry. And I think, like, you know, no, you just don't, you know, how many books of poetry do you own? They say 0 to 2. You know, how many novels do you own? And they say dozens, you know, if they're in their first year, you know, maybe a couple dozen in their first year, maybe a few in their third year. And I'm like, yeah, look at that ratio. That's not, you know, I'm getting up to like triple figures of poetry books just in my little home office. I'm like, whoa, that's all I read now is poetry. And I still can't keep up, right? But my students, you know, they misread a poem or they don't get a poem. And then they just put down poetry forever. And I think, well, how many novels do you not get? Or never finish, but at no point do you say, oh, I'm just going to quit reading novels, right? Because I just don't understand them, right? That sentence never comes. So I think what we need as poets and as publishers of poetry, Kate, you know, and, you know, I'll include Kate and Anthony in this, is to just try and get our readers to that accessibility thing. I think Kate, you mentioned that as well earlier too, right? It's to me, and Greg, you're saying it as well. I think when you say if it's beautiful and.
But does it have to be beautiful? I don't know, right? Like this is and this really comes full circle to me during, like, it gathers all of the threads of this conversation, going back to like BP Nickel and you know, how prolific they were also just like trying stuff, putting it out, trying stuff, put out a pamphlet, put out this, put out that, put it out in the street, like get into hands, you know? And also the conversation we were having about like the will to publish, the will to be like, to create beautiful things, the will for it to be perfect. And I think bullshit. I say bullshit on it all, because, you know, one of the reasons why Danny and I created Gap Riot is to create a space for people to fail. And I think as many times as you put out good things, you should be putting out things that you're not okay with and that you don't think are beautiful and perfect, because that's how we grow and we create conversation. And we also create a space for people to join us, and it becomes less, you know what I mean? Like it's more of an inviting space, and it's more of a space that people can try stuff on and not have to worry that, oh, this is their magnum opus. But like Small Press began and like still continues in that vein, right? Like that's one of the differences between Small Press and bigger house presses, is like, you don't have to have your magnum opus written. Just give us 13 pages that you're not sure of and we'll throw it out there and see how it sticks. And I really think that really resonates for me here. And I think there's a huge important purpose and space for that.
Is it a readerly, writerly space though? Like, are most of, you know, is your audience mostly other writers? That's for me, that's the thing I'm trying to like bridge path. That's the bridge I want to get over.
Well, I can tell you that one of our recent publications by Earthika Khan, we sold like close to 200 copies of that, and they were all to her family in Saskatoon. you know, it became this like gift economy, right? So like, so I would say no. I think
I hope I hope so. Yeah, that's well, what yeah, we want.
Like,
right?
And I mean, you know, Greg, like we've and Anthony, we've talked about this too. Like, you know, small press fairs are excellent because you always get people stumbling out of from the street, being like, "What the hell?"
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And you're like, "Well, come on over. Like, take a look at these like little cool things." And then, and then they're like, "Oh, I didn't even know this existed." And you know, so like, I think there is space for it not just being like a niche thing. I think you know, and I think social media allows for that too. But yeah. So,
but it's I really like your point though, Kate, that it doesn't need to be beautiful. But I guess for me, what makes a book beautiful is when it finds its perfect size, scale, and fit in the world.
Yeah.
And so you know, like those pamphlets that they were making back in the 60s, some of them they would do in editions of 12 or 15.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be an edition of 2,000 every time.
Yeah.
Let's not get stuck on a definition of what is beautiful here. Like, I mean, I think it can be, it's a wide church.
You know, it's a wide church. But that moment of chance and being alive and active in the world is so essential and important. And I wouldn't say to any poet, no, don't publish your poetry because we've already have enough of it.
I wasn't saying that.
I would always say to the poet, let me help you find a way to get that to its proper place. Like maybe that's not with, you know, sort of my wacky publisher friends. Maybe that's with some of the, you know, a more lyrical press or whatever. But there's probably going to be a home for that. And, you know, I would never say to somebody that you shouldn't. So coming at it from the poet's point of view, the answer is going to be very different to that question than from a publisher's point of view, where you're looking at all the books that get pulped at the end of a print run. And you know, you held up Apostrophe. I bought a box of, I think, 100 copies of that for $100 when it was getting pulped.
Cause wow. It's
one of the smartest, most beautiful books that I've seen ever. I love it. It was sent to the pulp. And so I
you scooped him up.
I scooped him up. And so I hand them out to people. It's like party favors, loot bags. You come to my birthday party, I'll give you a copy of this.
Bless you. Yeah. That's a great thing. What a great thing to do.
But you know, there's a case where even books that are, I guess in my head, have undeniable worth or undeniable place in the world. Even those have problems finding mass markets and have limited, you know, overreach by their publishers that leads to economic problems. And it's a waste when books get pulped. It's a terrible waste. And yet,
it happens.
Say no to a publisher. I'm not going to say no to a poet and say go get your book in print. Maybe have a smaller print run. That's the
limited run.
Well, then, if we're bumping into economics here, I mean, then poetry kind of loses. It's hard to make money off of it, right? Like, and I don't think it should be easy to. Mm-hmm. I'm not bewailing the fact. I just think, like, you know,
it's a subculture, and it'll never be a dominant culture again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless Rupert Kaur, you know, the herald of the future.
Right? Hey man, I don't mind that she's getting people into poetry, you know? Like it's gotta start somewhere. I'm never gonna speak ill of that.
The problem is that poets now say to each other, well, how many millions of copies has your book sold?
Yeah.
I suppose I could express it as a fraction of a million, but
that's right.
That's really funny. I'm trying to write out like a Fibonacci sequence in Roman numerals, like the first 500 Fibonacci numbers. And then I realized I didn't know how to say the 500th Fibonacci. Like the 500th Fibonacci number is a ridiculously large number. And I couldn't even say it in English. So I'm trying to translate it into English and then into Roman numerals for reasons that I can't describe anymore. But no one's going to want to read that. Like, it's such a dumb idea, right? But you have to, you know, I think if we're doing our job as writers, I think we have to do these really dumb
ideas. Nick Montford will want to read that.
Yeah. But that's about the size of the audience, you know?
Nick Anthony Franco.
Yeah. We work in small audiences, but it's always my desire to broaden it at every possible juncture, you know.
I will say that though, is like, because it's a smaller audience, like I feel so held by this community, you know, and I think especially like where I live, like here in Toronto especially too, but like there, you know, I've had some really, really beautiful correspondences and exchanges with people in my little Vizpo bubble lately. Yeah. And it's just been really sustaining. And so there is like, there's that, you know, and like, I've also been doing some really fun, like collaborative work, which like, God, can we do more of that? Like, you know, like PSW and I are doing a reply project where we like send each other an unfinished work every week and we finish each other's work. And it's just a really beautiful way of like getting to know someone and just like, you know, can we do that, more of that? Like, I think like those are really sustaining for us as we're kind of trying to figure this thing out too, right? And like, yeah. You know, so I've been really touched by how intimate this community is and how supportive it is of everyone, right? And so so there's that kind of upside to that too, but there's always room for more. It's just it is kind of nice in its way.
That's true.
I think collaboration between you and PSW is going to be really interesting to see if it ever.
Thank you, Clara. Next stop, you and me, girl. What are we doing?
Well, just let's have more collaborations between everybody. It's something I always feel like I need to make more time for.
I'm in, but I'm just so slow at the minute. I'm so busy with day job and
I hear you. Stuff. But it's like
maybe I need the prompts.
Yeah, like that's what I mean. Like there's like an accountability there. Like, you know, and it goes back to what I was saying to Nasser too about just like kind of like a practice of writing, you know, and like whether it's daily or weekly or what have you. Like Helen Hynoski and I have been collaborating loosely for years now too on something that we toss back and forth, and it's just like a really beautiful cadence, and we're forgiving at times when we need to be, but like keeping in touch that way and sharing more and being not afraid to share and do these things together is just like, it's really incredible, and it's been really sustaining throughout this whole thing. So yeah, more of that as well.
Cool. I know certainly for me, sometimes the prompt is what really helps me. I struggle, you know, with the cliche of the blank page.
Yeah. I think I just alienate people. No one wants to work with me.
Yeah, right.
But your version of a collaboration is what? So what's the 500th character?
Yeah, exactly. Next one. Yeah. Exactly.
Go look that up. Go figure out how to say 170. Ugh, so dumb.
But I think this goes back to the idea that we need more entrances and exits to the poem. And that blank page might seem threatening until you realize that there are people who are waiting for you to say something and want to hear through that piece of paper what you have to say. And that's where collaboration pulls you directly and immediately into that conversation. Mm-hmm. But publishing does too. And
standing in front of it, does. Yeah.
Performance is really crucial. It's the thing I'm missing. But more is important right now. I want more poets in my life right now. Yeah. I'm used to having them around me, and I can't see them anymore. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's hard too when you're teaching. I don't know if you're all teaching remotely as well, There's. I think this has been an interesting year to think about the physicality, you know, the embodied requirements for doing this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Something to reflect upon, you know, should things return to some form of normalcy?
For sure. It's been interesting too, like Anthony and Sarah, you probably feel this too. Like I went through a really rough patch at the beginning of the pandemic where I was like, no one wants to hear anything from me. Like there's other things going on in this world. And there was something so sustaining about licking and closing envelopes full of poetry and popping them in the mailbox and like doing that repeatedly and repeatedly and just like sharing other people's poetry and sending it off into the world that I just found incredibly therapeutic. You know, like it was just like, it was a really necessary task and it might seem mundane, but like just to be able to like spread that around and be open and create this space for other people, you know, a lot of them being their first works, like there was just something really beautiful about that act of sealing envelopes
yeah.
endlessly and stamping them and sending them off. And that, you know, it reminded me of why I do this and why I surround myself with that, you know. No, you don't.
No, you just get paper cuts.
We calculated that we've packaged up 2,000 books since the start of the pandemic.
Wow. Congratulations, that's fantastic.
Well done. So,
yeah.
And I do have the paper cuts to show. I, for some reason, I haven't learned how to not stab myself when I'm opening an envelope.
Well, you have a thousand, isn't it? 1,000, and then you die. You die by 1,000 cuts. Is that the
death by 1,000 cuts? Yeah. But the one thing that's been good for me is it has managed to keep my car ticking over because the post box in our village is really small. So when we've got parcels to post, I have to drive out.
Yes. Nice.
Yes.
That's good practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so do we have a little bit about the future of CanLit? If you dare to speculate.
Well, the future or your own individual futures, I suppose.
Yeah.
Like, Kate's got a future. Up. Holy cow. All these collaborations and books coming out. This is exciting times.
lots happening. I feel like it comes and goes. It's my survival tactic lately. But then now I'm worried that nothing is ever going to come again.
Well, what's the manuscript that you just finished?
I actually just finished a couple manuscripts, I just finished a visual poetry manuscript called Leavings, which is like a collection of my like visual poetry over the years that I've been meaning to put together into a book. I also have a manuscript under consideration with Invisible, which is a lyric and visual mix, which is really fun. And I think honestly doing full length books scares the hell out of me and I don't like it. and I feel like this, especially because I was trying to do a project where I was, you know, holding a bunch of discourses in a juggle and it was lyric and it was visual and I was just like out of my comfort zone and I feel like I had all this other work that was bubbling up and once I was able to send that off it like unleashed for me like a sense of relief and I was like, oh yeah, I've also been doing all like I've been stressed writing all these other things that are kind of fun and so it kind of like came and opened the floodgates. But yeah, no, there's like there's things floating around. Yeah.
Cool. Greg, what's happening on your PC?
Oh, I just finished something, so I'm never gonna write anything ever again. I'm that it's done.
Right.
what's exciting for me right now is actually I'm in the middle of a gig that involves opening up a new space for writing in Canada, and so we're just creating that right now. It's going to be a sort of a national forum for writers, particularly writers who are connected to universities, just because that community doesn't have any national home right now. But it does mean that there's going to be more events and things like that and plannings in the future. And so that's kind of taking up my mind. I'm really, my current theme here has been I need more access to human beings. And whether that comes through writing and expressive writing or through events and performance, it's something that I'm feeling pretty keenly right now, I think. And it's interesting, like, Kate, you're in Toronto, and Toronto has so many people. And I'm in St. Catharines, and one of the things that I've done in my life in St. Catharines is become a hub on the Poetry Railroad. And so people have, since I've moved here 15 years ago, I don't think there's been more than 2 weeks that has gone by where somebody hasn't been staying at my house who is doing a reading or doing an event or just passing through. And wow, that's just been my life here. And it's been a year and a half now. or whatever.
Do you guys know this about Greg? He has like this like old like bed and breakfast that he lives in, and it, like you can have your own little quarters in his house. And I've only been there a handful of times, but he has like big salons where people come read, and you can stay there, and it's really fun.
And I make breakfast in the morning. Yes.
Full bed and breakfast. Yes,
sounds idyllic.
And
we can't fly there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we haven't even done a launch for Franco's book that just came out.
Yeah,
that's the recent local thing that happened. So that's sort of on my radar. I'm going to plug away at this writing thing, but I want to have the conversations that surround it, and the silly conversations that happen, and the non-conversations that, you know, sometimes we can get together and talk about other things too. if need be. but it's good times afoot. The other thing I'm working on is the wrapping up the Dublin conference right now. We had a publication that's coming out, the Museum of Literature in Ireland, Molly, is working with UCD and launching a new press, a new journal. And that journal has a first issue, and the Dublin conference is the first issue. So,
lovely. So
it's going to be a lovely thing. And I really hope there's an in-person launch. We're actually hoping to do one in October in Ireland. And by that point, my God, by that point, this should be done, right?
Let's hope.
Yeah. So what about you, Nasser? What's on your radar?
Yeah, working on a few things. Yeah, I hope I'm not alone in this, but you know, you set off on you think you have a project that you're doing, but you end up writing something else.
yeah,
that's what's happened. So there is this odd little manuscript that's nearing a sort of completed first draft, and that's kind of me procrastinating on a really big project that I've going to take on next year, which will be about rhetoric and one particular little term that I found in there that really bothers me, but I'm not going to say much more than that. And then the side project will be trying to finish this Fibonacci thing, because I do love a good conceptual poem in spite of everything I've ever said thus far. But otherwise, you know, I'm opening myself up to reading all the new stuff I can get my hands on. I've enjoyed, not writing and just absorbing lots of new ideas and lots of great new writers. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. Wish I could be more specific, but the projects are kind of embryonic. But yeah, a book of love poetry, a book about rhetoric. And
last time you were on the podcast, you were very cryptic.
I have to be, otherwise I'm gonna I'm superstitious that way. If I say it all out, I used to do that. I'd talk about the book I was going to write, and then it would never get written. Mm-hmm. So I've learned instead, because you fool yourself into thinking, oh, well, then I've done it, right? Mm-hmm. I must have written it because I've told everyone about it. So I've started to just hold those things inside. But yeah, you know, the future's bright. And my students are great. And in the future, if we are talking about the future of experimental writing is in good hands if the dozen or so pieces that I've been reading from my students are any indication. There's some good work coming.
They are an indication. There's lots of things on the horizon, and it does feel like this is a turning point moment too. Part of that's the Black Lives Matter shift, that they said no, you can't just carry on as normal. Part of it is that the tools expanded and are now so diverse and so rich, you know, just the technology that's come available, let alone all the old tools which are still there to play with, like your Letrisettes. But you can take a Letraset and throw it on a Photoshop and do a million things that couldn't have been done just a short while ago. And it all of that is happening. And so is there a future? Of course there's a future for poetry, for experimental poetry. And I don't think it's ever been brighter than right now. I only see possibility ahead.
Okay. So it just remains to be said. It's been really nice seeing you again. And I think we covered all the main points of CanLit, yeah? Mm-hmm. Well, the CanLit we care about, the experimental.
The CanLit we care about.
Great, Mark. That's the catchphrase of this one.
That's the title for this episode.
Love that. My cheeks are like sore from smiling so much. So thank you. This really brings me a lot of joy to be with you all. Thanks, Anthony and Sarah, for always opening such great conversation and being interested in us.
it's been really fascinating. I think it says a lot that we haven't said much because we've just been listening.
Yeah.
It's been really great hearing you guys discuss this.
Well, I have to second Kate's thanks. Yeah. Anthony and Clara, you make a really valuable space open to a lot of people. And this is always an honor, flattered as ever, that you'd invite me. So thanks.
A true hub. You've built a true hub. You've probably provoked more writing than you could imagine by creating the kind of books that you do.
For sure.
While you're inundated by submissions, bear in mind that this is your own doing too, right?
Wrote it on ourselves.
To discover more, visit us at pentrightpress.com.